Talk given Sunday, 11th April, 1976. I should like today to spend a few minutes considering some of the basic teaching which goes under the name of Zen. I know some of you will be surprised because I've never done it in all these 14 years. Huineng, the sixth patriarch, as he is called, produced the famous sutra known as the Sutra of Huineng, which presents the fundamental teachings which have come to be known as Zen. We'll start with the basic affirmation. I say affirmation, not assumption. The essence of mind is utterly pure and perfect. It cannot be tainted. It is the supreme thing within ourselves. If the essence of mind is realized, then the dharma, that is, dharma means the truth, the doctrine, the teaching, is yours. And since the essence of mind lies within ourselves, and the realization takes place within ourselves, the truth, the doctrine or teaching or whatever you like to call it, the dharma, is known through ourselves. These are some of the fundamental ideas concerned with Zen. Now, you know the techniques that the Zen teachers employ. They have this technique which they call the koan. And they say something which, on the face of it, in ordinary intellectual terms, is utterly absurd and ridiculous. For instance, they say, if that is the sound of clapping of two hands, what is the sound of the clapping of one hand? Well, the question as it stands is perfectly ridiculous, not worth considering at all, for the very simple reason that the word clapping means that two objects have come together forcibly and made a noise. So you can't have a clapping with one hand. You must have two. This, of course, is logical intellect at play. But this is the kind of technique that they employ in order to assist the one who seeks enlightenment to transcend the limitations of logical intellectual processes. This is a kind of yoga which is quite different from the ordinary yoga, or rather, let me put it the other way, what we ordinarily regard as and know as yoga. But it is a yoga of its own type. Then there is another method in which the Zen teacher talks with the disciple and says something for which he wants an immediate answer. An immediate answer, preferably without thinking, which means without undergoing a logical intellectual process. Now there is tremendous sense in this. Because when you start thinking slowly, what you are doing is searching the corridors of memory. You are looking for the particular pigeonhole in which the information is stored up, which will enable you to answer what has been said by the teacher. Now, this is the wrong way. Because, not that the information which you may produce is false information, not necessarily, but because when you look into the corridors of memory, into the past, you are merely looking at what is finished with, what is dead, what is a fossil. So you're not going to grow that way. That which was the living circumstance and the living experience because of which that particular pigeonhole had all its proper documents put into it, you see, is over. You have outgrown that simply by virtue of the fact that time has passed and you are changed, you are different. So it's no good taking out the old fossils in order to answer the immediate now. Now you see, we all do that in ordinary life. And in ordinary life, we have to do it. Simply because the material, technical procedures, the know-hows of ordinary everyday living are more or less the same fixed know-hows. You learn to drive a car. All right, 60 years later, you will still be driving a car according to that old technique, of course. You see? You want to fry an egg. I don't suppose any man 50,000 years ago was able to fry an egg in any manner different from the way of frying an egg today. It's the same way. So it doesn't apply to that sphere. But to the sphere of the mind, the sphere of understanding, the release of intelligence, which enables you to transcend the limitations of fixed ideas and fixed beliefs and so forth, you have to have this different way. And the student answers back. And the more quickly they talk to each other and answer back, the better. Provided finally the student gets the right answer and all right, it's all right. Now there's another point in this connection which is very important. In the Sutra of Huineng, he mentions somewhat casually the necessity for the undefiled mind, for the pure mind, the pure heart. Whereas the sixth patriarch and the great Zen teachers, the great founders of Zen, did talk about and point out the necessity for the purification of the self, I'm afraid a good many others in our own day, for instance, do not give it sufficient attention, this particular point of the purification of the self. Why is this point so very important? For the same reasons as this point is of fundamental importance with ordinary Indian yoga. If you go through the discipline of postures and breathing and so forth, you must also bear in mind that the indispensable basis is purity of heart and mind. So too in Zen, it is necessary to have the pure heart and mind. Now why? If the mind is very sharp and quick, why can't it break through all its limitations just like that in a flash and realize enlightenment straight away? Consider this technique of question and answer. If you ask a question which is concerned with profound reality of a person who lives a dissolute life, an unmoral life, have you ever tried it out? See what answers he gives. If you ask that same question of a man whose life is pure, listen to the answers he gives. They are quite different. The man who lives an ill life has a mind which is clogged, which is diseased, which is confused in the depths. He cannot give you the answer which is of the nature of light. He will give you an answer which is the nature of a fog, which will only give you bronchitis perhaps. Now you see, this is a point which is not sufficiently looked into, not sufficiently emphasized. I said purity of the heart and purity of the mind. We all know what we mean by the purity of the heart, the ordinary moralistic meaning of purity there. Harmlessness, truthfulness, kindliness, charity, freedom from self-indulgence, from aggressiveness, and all that kind of thing. We understand all that. But do we really understand the meaning of the purity of the mind? Very few people ever look into the mind carefully. If we do, we will see that it is filled with biases, with prejudices, with all sorts of preconceptions, with misconceptions. And the mind is prone to make unwarrantable assumptions and imagine that these unwarrantable assumptions have validity where truth is concerned. Now these are the impurities of the mind. Now with a mind like that, when anything impinges upon that mind, interacts with that mind, the response of that mind will necessarily be confused, will necessarily be wrong, and so forth. Historically, we have the terrible phenomenon of the oppression and the cruelty and the devastating wars by one society in relationship to another society. Catholics and Protestants, Muslims and Christians, Hindus and Mohammedans, and so forth and so forth. Their minds are absolutely made arthritic, completely arthritic, with fixed beliefs with no foundation in truth whatsoever. In past centuries, in India, for instance, there was that sad period when it was enough to say to a Hindu, that's a Muslim, or vice versa, tell a Muslim, that's a Hindu, and immediately there is enmity. Why? The two are human beings just like each other, just as amiable, just as awful idiots, the same sort, no difference between them, in actual fact, but they'd go to war against each other, because the mind is utterly diseased with this prejudice, this bias. So uprises hate at the sound of certain words. Now this has been the case right through history. So the mind is impure. Now if the mind is purified, really purified this way, that is to say the intellectual part of the mind is purified, through unremitting, continuous observation of all that goes on in the mind, from moment to moment, what we call the practice of mindfulness, to be aware of what I am thinking and feeling in response to any and every stimulus that comes to me. If I practice mindfulness really diligently and earnestly, then I begin to heal the evil within my own mind. And the mind becomes clean and pure. It becomes open. It is ready to receive and listen to any and every idea, and not fight against it on the one hand, not reject it outright, nor swallow it outright, to be gullible. This is just as much a disease as to be gullible and to be incredulous is just as much a disease as being credulous and it's gullible and credulous against incredulous and with a tendency to reject out of hand. You'll be free from all that. The result is that if the mind is calm and poised and really considers and absorbs the impressions, the mental impressions that come to it, your power of intelligence, pure intelligence, grows. This is something unknown to the world as a whole, and has been unknown. None of our educational systems throughout the ages have a ghost of an idea of this. This thing which we call intelligence is the innate power hidden within the mind to see the truth of things immediately. This is intelligence. But it's a faculty we don't possess, because the mind, as an instrument of such perception of truth, has been rendered inefficient by all our conditioning. And all our conditioning exists as a collection, as a terrible collection, heaps of biases, prejudices, preconceptions, misconceptions, assumptions, beliefs, convictions, and so forth. In addition to that, we are so brought up that we have an absurd evaluation of the superiority of reason. Everything must be according to reason. But what is reason for any particular person's mind? A person's mind, which is absolutely hidebound, for him to be reasonable means this, that, and the other. And for the person whose mind is open and free, to be reasonable means something very different. So, what is reason? Why the emphasis upon reason? Exclusively upon reason, upon logic and logical processes. Those who know, truly know, see that life in its wholeness is illogical. It includes logic, which lies at the core of experience and perception and thinking. It also includes the illogical, that twilight realm, which gives elasticity to the intellectual processes, and it transcends both of them at the same time. Life is illogical. That is why life is unpredictable. Otherwise, we could just mechanically predict what's going to happen. So you see, all these things which characterize the minds of people are the illness, the dis-ease of the mind. And it's the practice of mindfulness in the right way which enables us to heal the mind. We have to start with what the mind actually is and transform it. We haven't got to throw out ideas. If we say, oh, I'm going to give up that system of ideas altogether, I don't agree with that philosophy anymore, what do? The mind, my own mind, already being inefficient and incapable of seeing truth, is only going to pick up another system of ideas and carry another load of rotten stuff. You see the point? So let me keep to the old rotten stuff and transform it. I'll make it first-class stuff. If I'm in line with life. You see how life works. Look at the way the sun's action upon the planet works. The sun doesn't throw anything out of the earth. It transforms it, transforms it, transforms it. Doesn't it? This is the nature of life. This is the nature of growth. And that is what we have to do. And in doing that, what is one of the most wonderful things we have made manifest? Love. If you as a parent, if I as a parent, have a child who is ill or suffering from something which is a sore trial, I don't get rid of the child. I don't throw it out of the window. I do everything that is possible to heal that child. And if I have intelligence, then this power of love within me will bring the warmth and the healing to that child. And the intelligence will show me gradually the right way to deal with that child. In each circumstance, in each new circumstance from day to day as it arises. So you see the importance of purification. You get both elements. Love itself will arise with the purity of the heart, with living the virtuous life. Virtuous in the ordinary limited sense, the not vicious life. And with the purity of the mind, the two together, intelligence and love, then the mind is pure and clean. When the mind is pure and clean, this essence of mind, the light within, the eternal, the immortal, that which never began, doesn't grow, doesn't change, doesn't die, doesn't end, that will just shine forth through that mind. And it is that sort of person who is the enlightened person. We say enlightenment can come suddenly. And we try to invent techniques for sudden enlightenment. Well, consider this matter carefully. What is this phenomenon, the nature of this phenomenon of suddenness? Everything in life undergoes a process of growth, if it's organic. If it's a particular technique, let me use the word mechanical in this context, if it is something mechanical, there is a cumulative effect. And there comes the point, in either case, when you reach what we may quite rightly call the critical point, and at that critical point there is the precipitation of the consequence of all these energies at play finding fulfillment suddenly. And to us it appears as sudden. This is the meaning of suddenness. If you study a subject like chemistry, for instance, and study chemical processes, you will see very clearly what I mean by this. A reaction proceeds, that is to say, a chemical process goes on for a long time, and then at last the effect suddenly precipitates itself. And there you are. The new thing has come into being. This is the suddenness. But you see, it reaches, whatever is done, reaches a critical point, and then the result of all that you have done through the last 50 years or 10 years or 10 months or 10 days apparently shows itself. Now you'll ask me, but why do you say 50 years? Why isn't it 50 years with everybody? Why is it 50 hours with somebody? Here comes in the element of the blueprint with which we are born. When each one of us is conceived, the activity of the chromosomes and so on lays down a blueprint, a physical blueprint of what I am going to be at the time of my conception. And as the embryo grows, and then after my birth, the growth of the brain, the ductless glands, the nervous system, and so on, they all are subject to nature's fundamental fiat, so to say. And so I am I, and you are you as you are, basically and fundamentally. Now this is just a human being's understanding and perception of it. But every human being, if he has that much wisdom, and my saying this means, of course, that I do have that much wisdom, must realize, must acknowledge, and bear in mind that apart from what I as an individual can see of the true nature of things, there's an infinitely greater amount which I don't see. And all those forces are also at play. If you can sort of meditate on this, let the mind dwell quietly on it and understand it, you will understand You will not produce a set of ideas to say that this is the true explanation, but you will understand how a Mozart comes into being, or a Shakespeare, or a stupid person, and so forth. This is how life works. A life in its immensity, in its totality. As I said earlier, every atom influences the cosmos, and the whole cosmos affects the atom. Just think of it. The total universe affects each and every one of us all the time, but you and I don't know it. And it is the mercy of nature, the mercy of God, whichever you like, both if you wish, you see, which prevents us from knowing it. Otherwise we'd be shattered by the immensity of that impact upon our poor little brains. So you see, it just happens. It just happens. And here is the beauty of it all. So now, to come back to this business of enlightenment, sudden enlightenment, this essence of mind, which is utterly pure and perfect, realizes enlightenment through the living of the religious life in the full sense of the word.